So everybody, welcome. In this time, just do a quick check-in on how everybody's doing, and then we'll have Deanna talk about moving your practice online, some of the things you need to be aware of. So how's everyone doing?
Good.
Doing well. As good as it gets.
I love your background with the beach.
Thank you.
Well, as many of you know, Deanna has been a ILCT faculty member for what, 10 or 11 years?
At least,
yeah. She also runs Online Therapy Institute and really is probably one of the lead experts on doing therapy and the ethical considerations when you are working online with people. And that also applies to coaching. So Deanna, take it away.
Hi, everybody. I don't really want this to be a lecture. I'm hoping I will give some introductory points and then we can turn it into a dialogue. So if any of you have burning questions, you're going to have an opportunity to ask. And so I started out doing online therapy in 2000, so 20 years. And when I first started, it was email and chat. There wasn't a lot of video going on, and while we had the phone, there wasn't a lot of audio. And that was very new to the field of therapy, but I realized in 2000 and before that, that coaches were already working via the telephone. So coaches kind of had a head start on working from a distance. But now, I don't know how many of you are doing, I know you're doing it now because of the pandemic, but how many of you were doing video before the pandemic? Now video is the most popular method of delivery for therapy. I'm kind of old school. I like doing email and chat. I think can be very powerful. But anyway, a little bit about the history. Online therapy started in 1959 at the University of Nebraska with a psychiatrist who saw his group, did group therapy via satellite. So all of the patients were in a room and they were watching what looked like a TV and they could see their doctor. So that's as far back in history as we can trace the technology. And then over time we had some artificial intelligence experiments that were supposed to be like person-centered, where you say something and the computer parrots back. So that was not a huge success, but it was part of the journey to where we are now. And the only way therapists had ever worked from a distance before 2000, really, in any significant way, was probably hotlines. So, you know, if you've ever worked a hotline, you know that that is working from a distance. And when I was an undergraduate, I trained to be on the domestic violence hotline. And so when I finally started, and that was a long time ago. So when I finally started doing online therapy, I had a comfort zone about it because I was accustomed to having dealt with crisis or dealt with situations from a distance. And so for 20 years, I have had some sort of practice, whether it be coaching or therapy or students or whatever. I've been working from a distance for that 20 years. And when I had a face-to-face practice, I always used online as an adjunct. So even my face-to-face clients in the early 2000s became accustomed to, you know, either getting in a chat with me or doing an email exchange. So I've always, for 20 years, I've had my hands in it. And now with the pandemic, everybody is launching forward to be online. And if you're doing it, you know that there are some glitches. It's not always perfect. So, and if you are in any of my trainings, you know that sometimes the learning platform is glitchy because there are so many people on the learning platform that the bandwidth just can't handle it. Same with Zoom. We're on Zoom today. It seems to be clear, but that's not always the case. So that's a real brief introduction to how I started and what it looks like now. And some of the things, I sent Amy a blueprint that you all will get after the call, and it's 25 questions you need to consider when you think about going online. Like, these are the sort of some of the things you need to be aware of. And some of them are very basic, like who's in the room. So if you're seeing a client via video, have you prepared the client for the session? Have you talked about what happens if there's a technology breakdown? Have you talked about whether they have a private space to have the session with you? Have you talked about, you know, other alternatives other than video? Because if you've got face-to-face clients and they don't want to do video, are you prepared to deliver services in another way? And then there are some theoretical implications that you need to know about. And that starts with online disinhibition, which was written about probably mid-90s by John Suler. He's at Rider University. Basically, what the disinhibition effect is that people tend to do and say things they would not ordinarily do and say when they're online. And that bears out in every method of delivery, whether it's email, chat, audio, video. And so that's something that a coach and a therapist need to be aware of. And it doesn't just happen with our clients. We are all subject to online disinhibition if we're not paying attention. So fortunately, coaching is more collaborative. So there's not so much this in therapy, you know, therapist, there's this whole idea that the therapist is the expert. And so when people are online, sometimes that line of authority gets blurred and it can feel like peer to peer. That flies with coaching. So I think the coaching community is much more transparent when they're online. You know, I'm not so much worried about what's behind me as a coach as I am a therapist. I don't know about the rest of you, but I believe that some of that transparency contributes to the authenticity of the presentation when we're online. And it's a little different when we're therapists, when we're in that role. So online disinhibition, anonymity, fantasy, transference, all of those things happen whether you're in the role of coach or therapist. And I think it's an important theoretical concept to understand. In fact, I think it's the most important theoretical concept to understand when you're working online. Because it's one of those you don't know what you don't know. So if you're not aware of it, you're not going to recognize it when it's happening. And some of you may have already experienced some of that. If you were seeing somebody face to face and then you went online and suddenly they seem different, or they're more open, or they're telling the story with much more flourish and zest. So it's just something to be aware of. So I'm going to stop and see if there are any obvious questions at this point.
And if so, you just want to unmute yourself down in the lower left corner.
We got a shy group.
So I'll jump in. So Deanna, who should not move over onto online? Obviously people who are not technologically comfortable, but you and I've also had discussions about people who may not necessarily be safe.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So anybody that's in a situation, and there are many people in this situation right now during the shelter in place, anybody that's in a potentially harmful living situation, involved with or has a partner that is engaging in domestic violence, you really don't need to be seeing anybody that you're aware of that's involved in a violent relationship, even if it's just verbal at that moment. You really don't need to take those people online, because technology has changed the game for stalkers and domestic violence perpetrators. So, and for one, shelter in place right now, it's really hard for people to have privacy within some of their living spaces. But in general, somebody who is involved with domestic violence is a victim. They stand to put themselves and you at harm by going online, because being online is very, very easy to trace. So you can have things like a keystroke program installed on your phone or your laptop. And that means that the perpetrator has installed this app or this software that you are unaware of. It's stealth. You cannot detect it if you try to see if somebody has installed it. And the perpetrator can witness that from another screen, from another device, and can see every keystroke, literally every message, every keystroke, every email, everything that has gone on with the victim. So while we're on video, we're still logging in, we're still typing in passwords, we're still doing all of that, and a perpetrator could retaliate against the victim. So you just need to be very careful. Also, these can be recorded. I mean, we have control of recording Zoom or if we're on another platform, but there are apps that can record internally. And then the perpetrator could be seeing the entire session. And you can imagine that if your role as a coach is to empower, that would be a really tricky situation if the perpetrator got a hold of any information or even knew that the partner was seeking services from a therapist or a coach. So just be very, very aware of that. And my stretch for offering any sort of support to somebody who is coming out of a domestic violence situation, and you may be a career coach, you know, doesn't mean they're coming to you to deal with any of that. They may be coming to you for just so they're attempting to get their life back. But if they have not been out of that relationship for at least 3 months, preferably 6, and ideally a year, you really don't need to be doing any sort of coaching or intervention online, because when I worked at the domestic violence shelter in a long time ago, the recidivism rate, the return for the victim, it took 7 times coming into the shelter before they finally decided to leave for good. So when somebody's been away for 3 months, that's probably not enough time to consider her, him, or you safe.
And Deanna, does that also apply to phone conversations if you're coaching somebody?
Yes, it applies especially.
All in the same house?
Especially mobile phones. Mobile phones are very, again, just any app can be installed on somebody's phone that's not password protected. And it can be recorded. The only phone really that's absolutely secure is a landline. And both people have to be on the landline. And I'm not talking about cable, because I have what we call a landline phone, but it's cable. It's not the jack in the wall. So, and how many of us have the phone with the jack in the wall? Chances are both parties are not going to have that.
Okay.
You know, and the victim can may choose to record a phone call for their own purposes, and the perpetrator can find it.
So it's something to be aware of.
Yes.
Especially right now, as you said, the cases are going up because everybody's stressed, everybody's stuck in their homes.
Yes.
So have a referral?
Referral would be, I will give it to Amy to send. It's a really, really awesome webpage that lists shelters and hotlines for domestic violence all over the world. So it's a wonderful resource.
That would be great.
But you want to, more than referring to a therapist, because again, the victim's going to be in the same situation and put herself, himself, and or the therapist at risk, really need to refer to a domestic violence hotline because they are skilled to deal with it.
Good, thank you.
Okay, and while we're on the topic of, you know, the not so fun stuff, if perchance you're online and your client is in crisis, which hopefully doesn't happen very often in the coaching space, but it can happen. If you think they're going to harm themselves or somebody else, you need to contact the authorities, but you need to contact the authorities where they live, not 911. Because all 911 is going to do is cause a great big delay. So I say that because it's important when you're working online that you know where your client is. You know, what is their address? Because that's the best way to intervene. And the local police will handle it from there, and they can trace the ISP. You could ask somebody if you were concerned about a client. You could ask the police to do a drive-by safety check. Many times they're more than willing to do that. So I know that's not the, that's not the culture of coaching, but things are different when we're working online.
Well, and the ICF did change their code of ethics about a year and a half ago, so that if you are concerned that they will harm themselves or they will harm someone else, or they're doing something illegal, you are now, as a coach, obligated. And we hold all of our students to that as well.
Okay, so then this is an important piece.
Yeah.
And again, because of disinhibition, your clients may say and do things they wouldn't normally say and do. They may lean, and because of the extreme amount of stress that people are going through during the pandemic, they may tend to lean on you for more emotional support than what you would typically be doing as a coach. So you just need to be aware of that. Sort of have your finger on the pulse of your clients and their anxiety levels as related to the pandemic.
Sorry about that. Does anyone else have any other questions, comments, sharing what you're going through?
Has anyone experienced anything I'm talking about?
No, ILCT only has good clients.
Okay, in the chat, Robin Wright says, I have a coaching agreement that includes a few sentences about the fact that I may need to report if someone is going to harm themselves, etc. This has been due to the fact that I'm an LICSW. Okay, that makes sense. That's what I have in mind.
And really, you should have separate contracts for both coaching and social work.
Yes, definitely. I don't do social work. I only do coaching.
Right.
But I put that in there because as a licensed social worker in the state, I am beholden to report.
Right. Okay. That makes sense, Robin.
Yeah.
Right.
And
for people who hold an ICF credential, that should be in your contract. And for the BCC, I forget what their wording is exactly, but that's where the ethical piece comes in. of letting, and I'm pretty sure the BCC has a right to right? To need to notify?
I'm not recalling that in the BCC, but because when I have taught this before, I would say to people, yes, you do need to have two contracts, but if we are already licensed as a mental health practitioner, okay, so we'll take it as a what if. So what if somebody is a BCC and there's nothing in the ethics about reporting, and they're also a licensed social worker, and they have their coach agreement, they have their therapy agreement, but their coach agreement doesn't say anything about reporting harm. Because they are licensed in the state, they're held to the standard of their license, not the certification.
Right.
So they have to inform the coaching client that I have this license, and because of this, I'm bound to make a report.
Right.
And the only thing I was going to say is if you don't have that in the contract, and I'm asking this question, and then you feel the need to report and you've never mentioned anything like that to your coaching client.
Right.
Is that problematic? I mean,
that's real problematic. And in fact, if your client decides, you know, they did tell you something confidentially in the coaching arrangement, and they realize after the fact that you didn't take care of them, they could report you to your licensing board and say, you know, I was in a coaching relationship with my coach, who's also a therapist, and I was dealing with some mental health issues, and she didn't refer, and she didn't report, she didn't do anything. Because sometimes our clients are more savvy than we give them credit. You know, they've already looked us up, and they know who we are and what we do.
Which is why we put so much emphasis on really doing your coaching contract based on your own circumstances. So we've right. got, what I think, 8 different samples in the Foundations Library. And if you don't have those, Amy can always send them out to you or drop them in your library. But so that for those who are therapists, they have one thing. For those who are ICF or BCC, they have the wording they need to have, especially in a case like this. So Gay asks, are there certain video conference apps that are better or safer than others, like Zoom?
Okay, so I know we're having a lovely time here, but I do not recommend Zoom for client interaction. Zoom has many, many, many security issues. And I think most of Zoom's conversations and videos are run through servers in China, and that's where the security breaches have been. There have been other security breaches where, you know, we're in a meeting like this, and then we all get spammed with porn. So while I may be willing to take that chance here with you all, I don't know that I would want to take that chance with a client. If I know that that's happening, and if you don't know about that, just Google it. You know, and of course Zoom is doing everything they can to fix the security breaches, but it's not completely fixed yet. So my point about that is, if we know that that exists, why would we put our client at that potential risk? So there are many, many web conferencing platforms. There's anytime you've done a webinar, you've been on either a learning platform or a video platform that would be suitable. There are many telemental health platforms that are HIPAA compliant. And while we don't need to be HIPAA compliant as coaches, it doesn't hurt to have that extra layer of security. So I use doxy.me, and they have a free version. VC, V as in Victor, SEE is another platform. I don't think they have a free version anymore. Generally, the platform is going to be between $30 and $50 a month if you're paying for it. There's a platform called vtconnect.net. And that platform has been in existence for at least 10 years. I know the person who started it. She is a nurse and a PhD therapist. And she has recently opened her platform up to coaches. So the way her platform works, it's very much like this. And you have all the bells and whistles. You can share your screen. You can't do large groups, but you can do groups up to 6 or 7. She said reason is the bandwidth right now. She has a directory. So if you're in the directory as a therapist or a coach, you must be vetted. They're going to check your certifications and your licenses. But if you don't want to be in the directory, you can just sign up and get a link that you share with your clients. And then you have a platform like this to use with your clients. So, I mean, there are literally hundreds of platforms out there.
Deanna, Michelle asks about Practice Better and Coaches Console. Do you know of either of those?
I know Coaches Console, and why is that, like, making me frown? I can't remember. Of course, what I would know about either one of those would be old news. So, most of these sites have like a free demo. They'll either show you with a link or you can call and they'll do a demo with you and walk you through it. I think that's very important when you're deciding on what platform. I know right now we're all using whatever we can get our hands on. And really, if you don't want to do platform, FaceTime is very, very secure. FaceTime has not had any of the security issues. The reason therapists can't use it, because it is encrypted at the level that HIPAA requires, but Apple, which is FaceTime, is not going to enter into a business associate agreement with with the medical community. So they just don't want to be in the healthcare space. But FaceTime itself is actually very secure. So how do you do your due diligence? How do you do the demos? Google to see what the reviews are. Go into your forums or your, you know, like we have the coaches community. Is anybody using Coaches Console? You know, that's how I found Doxy.
And especially because we don't, coaches are not legally required to be HIPAA compliant.
Right.
It's sort of more of a gray area. Are you saying that is something that if people are looking for a platform, they should be looking for is HIPAA?
Well, that is your best standard. That doesn't mean that it can't be hacked. You know, just because it's HIPAA compliant doesn't mean it's, you know, somehow got a gate of protection around it. But it demonstrates that as any sort of practitioner, you've done your due diligence to make sure you can find the most ethical and reliable platform to use with your clients. So VT Connect is HIPAA compliant, and it's a platform for both coaches and therapists. So right. Zoom is none of that. Zoom is not in the healthcare space.
Anyone else have any experience on different platforms that they've liked?
Okay, I see a question. What about WhatsApp or Teams from Teams from Microsoft? I've heard is pretty good.
Google Meeting has a new one.
Yep. And Zoom has a HIPAA compliant version. Yes, they do have the business version, but it got hacked. I'm thinking what else I've used. Well, for email, you know, in the ethical framework for the use of technology and coaching that we recently rewrote, WebEx, yes. Skype, not so much. GoTo, yes. GoToWebinar, yes. And let me back up. The reason I say no to Skype is because, again, Skype, like Zoom, has been fraught with security issues. And Skype is one of those apps that you download on your phone or your laptop or your desktop, and it is like an open portal for viruses. So Skype is a dirty word to me because I had my entire computer wiped from Skype, from having Skype on my computer. Like, I had nothing left. So just be aware.
And they're not HIPAA compliant, right?
No. Well, yes. Like Zoom, they have a business version that, and they will enter into a BAA agreement. They didn't always have that, but they do now.
Okay.
So for email involving clients, do you recommend using Hushmail for everything? Can a coach make it simple and use Hushmail for? Yes. Hushmail is so easy. It's not easy at the onset if you want to use your own domain name and all of that, but Hushmail's support is excellent and they will walk you through it. They'll do whatever they can to get you set up. They also have secure forms. So instead of having a form on your website that just says, you know, send me a message and let me know how I can help, because that's not very secure unless it's a secure form, Hushmail provides the secure forms. I believe Hushmail just created a system so that you can, like, if you've got a questionnaire or something that you give clients, they can put that on your website, or you can just use Hushmail to send documents back and forth. So, and if you don't want a branded Hushmail email, I think my business Hushmail is like $40 a year. It's not that expensive. I've used Hushmail for 20 years. And the way it works, if your client does not have a Hushmail account, then you send them an email and they receive a link. They open it with a password. They create a password. And then every time you send them something, they open it and they can respond. So I do all of my, I did online therapy through Hushmail for years. And if I have to send anything to any client, or if I'm doing email work, it's Hushmail. So I use Hushmail for email, and I use doxy.me for video, audio, and chat.
Deanna, spell doxy.me.
D as in David, OX as in X-ray, Y dot me, M-E.
Thank you.
I'll put it in the... Okay, so one of the things we're talking about in the online therapy camp is, you know, when you're in a session and the bandwidth isn't good, the tech's not working, you know, what do you do? Well, hopefully you've prepared your client so that there's like a backup plan if that happens, because you don't want your client to think you disconnected on purpose. But the first obvious thing you can do is remove the video and just go audio, because you're saving bandwidth. If that goes wonky, you can remove the audio and just do chat like we're doing in this Zoom over on the side. So you don't have to necessarily lose your client and disconnect and reschedule. You can continue at least long enough to come up with the next steps. So that's just something to keep in mind.
Good suggestion.
Not all platforms have that three-way ability, but I know like Doxy and I think WebEx and they all have that ability to just go down to chat.
Great.
Anybody have a question? Pick my brain.
Yeah. Gay wants to know, do you have suggested language for how to prepare your clients for video coaching?
Well, the first thing I would do is ask if they've ever been in a video. Even like, have you used video with your family? How comfortable are you with it? And then I would just talk through, you know, if, especially if you've seen them face to face, it's not going to be the same experience. It's going to be similar. We'll be able to see each other. But you know, technology is technology. So we might have some lag time, or I'm talking and the words aren't matching my lips and vice versa. Eye contact might be a little different. And so you just talk to them like you're just preparing them for the difference in the experience. And how much you have to prepare them for that depends on whether they're tech savvy at all, whether they use video at all for any purpose, work or family. If they do, then they're going to know that, and you just remind them that tech doesn't always work the way we want it to. And then you come up with your plan, whatever that is. If the technology breaks down, you know, we'll try again in 30 minutes, or I'll send you a link to my scheduling app and we'll reschedule, whatever your system is for that. And if you're used to seeing somebody via telephone or mobile phone and you've never seen the person and you go to video, you need to be aware that you are adding in the sense of sight. And so when you add in senses, as if we said with email, we've never seen each other, we've never talked to each other, I've never heard the voice, and you ramp up to chat, which adds real time, and then you ramp up to telephone, which adds oral cues, then you ramp up to video and you have the full visual cues. That's very difficult to do, to go from email to video. It's much easier to go from full on all the senses, like face to face, okay, now we're gonna do video, or face to face to audio. So just keep in mind, if you're going from phone to video, that's also something you might want to prepare your client for. You know, we've been talking on the phone, we've never really seen each other, so we need to give ourselves a few minutes when we log on and prepare for the different experience.
And I'll testify that it is different. I've been talking to Deanna for about 12 years over the phone and only have seen her now twice in a Zoom meeting. It's like, oh my gosh, that's what she looks like? It's very distracting. Right?
I'm sorry.
Wasn't it weird the first time?
Yeah. Well, and a funny story is, and this is part of disinhibition, because we all have a story in our heads about when we hear a voice or we read a book, right? We read a book, we can see the landscape in our heads. They describe scenery and we get a picture of it. Then we see the movie and the movie's like, no, that's not the picture that was in my head, right? So I was at a conference in, I think it was like 2005 or six, at the American Counseling Association conference. And Kate, my colleague at Online Therapy Institute, came from England. And we had been talking regularly through chat and email for years because we were both colleagues in another organization. We were on a board together, but I had never heard her voice. So I'd seen pictures of her, but I'd never. So the first thing that when she came up to me and introduced herself, my first thought was, wow, she's got a British accent. Like, of course she did. But that wasn't the voice in my head that I had ascribed to her all those years. So that's an idea of what can happen when we move through different methods of delivery. And when we move through methods of delivery, it's called omni-channeling, because we can go from video to email, email to chat, chat to audio. And if your client is open to it and you're comfortable with it, the more you can do that, the lens that you view your client from becomes much richer. So if you've only ever done phone, or you've only ever done face-to-face and now video, having an email exchange with your client can be extremely powerful. And that looks like saying to your client, you know, between now and the next time we meet, I would love it if you just write down your impressions of this session we just had. give me your thoughts about your next steps. I know we talked about it, but I'd like to, for you to think about putting it in writing. And then you have the opportunity to respond to them with all of the powerful questions. And then you can either continue that or bring the result of that email exchange into the next session.
Well, something you said that Lisa also said is you have to be comfortable with whatever modality yes. you're going to choose. And you've got to make sure that your client is and not push that just because everybody's on Zoom.
Right, right. That's very important because, well, for one, and I realize that some of us have had no choice during the pandemic. You know, I'm working with therapists across the country who have no choice but to see their clients online. They've never been on video. They never wanted to be on video. And that's a huge paradigm shift. And the biggest issue with that is if they don't want to be online or they don't believe online relationships are real, they're not going to be able to execute that dialogue. It's not going to feel authentic. So as much as possible, we need to work within the modality and the method that we're most comfortable with and match it to our clients' needs. The flip of that is, after this pandemic, I've had many therapists say to me, well, when this is over, I'm going back to my face-to-face office. And my response to that is, sure, if your clients want to.
Good point.
Because clients are going to find out that, oh, okay, this works. Like one of my friends had her dermatology appointment via video. She's like, oh my God, why would the doctor or me put ourselves through the whole meet and greet and all that if we don't have to? So there's going to be a whole, there's going to be so many shifts are coming. And we will continue to be virtual to some extent in the way we reach out to people, whether it's personal or professional. What is my opinion about private Facebook groups? No. Not if it's personal, shared personal information. You know, I have a private Facebook group for my students. That's different. But I make it clear that we're not staffing cases. We're not talking about, it's very, when it comes to client cases, it's very general information. But I would not use a Facebook group for coaching per se. I would use a Facebook group perhaps for education.
For a way to connect like the ILCT one.
Right.
But not working with clients? Is that the question?
I think that is. What is your opinion about private Facebook groups? They're not private enough. That's my opinion. I don't know how nosy my Mark Zuckerberg is, so. Oh, that's funny. Michael said, I've taken your online CBC course when we've exchanged so many emails over a year. I envisioned you as a Brit. So, you know, maybe it was because the original CBC, I think it was spelled in the British way. And Glodina does her lecture, which is, she has an accent, so. Martha Hyman to everyone, hand raised. Okay. Can you unmute?
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
If I could go back for just a second to the creation of a comfortable platform. My grief coaching with you all evolved into becoming an end-of-life doula as well. And in this sort of circumstance, the creation of sort of ritual, I think, can help bring people who aren't used to this kind of a visual platform when we're not in each other's midst sometimes just a moment of deep breathing at the beginning, maybe. Maybe even, you know, a 30-second guided imagery, a minute-long guided imagery, just to make our time together that much different than what's going on in the rest of the world or in our house, and can really create a closeness that might need to happen with our being so far apart. I find that that's helpful for me.
Thank you.
I think that, you know, when everybody thinks that video needs to be like the talking heads, like we are here. But, you know, we can pan out. And, you know, family, couples and family therapists all the time pout so they can see the couple sitting on the couch together, so they can see the family interact. There are a lot of parent educators that are working online now who are, you know, can't make the home visit, so they're viewing the family via video. So whatever we can do to sort of break up this talking heads piece, I think is a good thing. And I've noticed that a lot of, I'm in a couple of, they're more like peer support groups. And we have started, you know, starting the group with a meditation. Just as you said, to feel like it's, there's something a little different than the four walls we're all looking at.
Yes.
It's a really good suggestion. And I think with what's going on, the grief coaching obviously is big, but people are losing rituals.
Yes.
You're not planning funerals and coming together and giving each other a hug, which I think is just devastating.
And that's feeling like another loss unto itself.
Exactly.
So I'm doing a lot of that kind of work. Yeah.
I can imagine. Well, it's important work. Anyone else?
So I work with a lot of teens and young adults. And sometimes when you're doing video coaching, they are doing other things on their computer. And I'm wondering what tips or techniques have you used to help your clients focus on the work at hand?
Well, I don't work with children and youth, but I do have a couple of guides. They were geared toward therapists, but they are guides on working with children and youth via video. I'm happy to send that to you. Because there's some pointers in there that are across the board coaches and therapists can benefit. But I do recall, this was probably 10 years ago, a therapist, it was an article in Psychotherapy Networker, and she had this really stealth rule that when she saw her adolescents, they had to leave their phones outside of the room. And she decided to experiment. And so she allowed her clients to bring their phones in. And in one session, they had this moment of silence, and the adolescent was not coming forth with anything. And so she picked up her phone, the adolescent picked up her phone and messaged to the therapist, "You don't get me." And that opened the entire dialogue. So I think that goes back to, you know, coaches have the opportunity to be a little more transparent, a little more, I don't know, real with their clients. And so part of that is realizing that that is part of children and youth culture. You know, and we all know the research says we can multitask and learn. You know, there was a study years ago, I wish I had it, but it was sort of taking a situation like this where we're all looking at each other, somebody's lecturing, and then there's the chat on the side. And what the study suggested was that if you take the chat away, because the lecturer wants, the person that's lecturing wants to be in charge, wants to be the ego that's presenting to everybody, and this side chat over here is just annoying to some. Well, what they learned was that the side chat, having the side chat meant that we were using multi-sensory input and we retained the information better. So, you know, I'm not saying we need to tolerate complete avoidance, which is different, but if they're engaged, then I wouldn't, personally, I would kind of go with the flow.
But if they're off playing a video game on Facebook, right, and they're supposed to be learning.
Right, that's different, but
yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So it sounds like a lot of people would appreciate you also sharing that guide.
Okay.
So we'll let Amy put together a, we'll have Deanna send Amy a bunch of stuff and you guys will get an email with them.
Okay. Yeah. And just keep in mind, they are therapy guides, but take what you can out of it. In fact, we should just create one for coaches.
Yeah, because it didn't take us long to redo the framework, right?
No, just a few years.
Our next project.
Oh, yeah. My daughter is 13 and can have 3 screens going on at once, or 1 or 2 screens while she's studying. Yeah.
That's amazing.
I'm glad this was helpful.
It was.
And we do have a class at Life Coach Training Institute on online coaching. Introduction to online coaching. It's a 6-hour course. 5 hours, 6 hours.
Five hour,
yeah.
Yep. That's on sale through the pandemic.
Yes, it is. I'm glad you found
it. I will link to that in the email also. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Great. Well, Deanna, thank you.
Thank you.
And you guys, as our faculty member, Deanna is always very available to students. So, you know, you can very easily find her at ILCT.
Yeah.